Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 11th of May, these are our main stories. The British Prime Minister signals a change of emphasis on the coronavirus lockdown rules. Italy rolls back from a scheme that saw convicted mafia figures released from jail and placed under house arrest. And are measures to combat racism against Africans in China working. Also in this podcast, heading to Austria, will you choose 14 days in quarantine or a coronavirus test costing about $200?
It's an important first step in the service for those who are forced to travel now.
And has coronavirus killed off kisses as a social greeting?
This is one of the good sides of COVID-19. I will not have to kiss people that I don't like because they have bad breath or because they have crusty hair or whatever.
In Germany, coronavirus infections are rising days after the country eased its lockdown restrictions. South Korea's president says the country must be prepared for a long war against the virus amid fears of a second wave after a new outbreak. Meanwhile, here in the UK, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, in a televised address to the nation, has announced a gradual unwinding of the coronavirus lockdown.
It is now almost 2 months since the people of this country began to put up with restrictions on their freedom, your freedom, of a kind that we have never seen before in peace or war. And you have shown the good sense to support those rules overwhelmingly. You've put up with all the hardships of that programme of social distancing because you understand that as things stand, and as the experience of every other country has shown, it's the only way to defeat the coronavirus, the most vicious threat this country has faced in my lifetime. And though the death toll has been tragic and the suffering immense, and though we grieve for all those we have lost, it is a fact that by adopting those measures we prevented this country from being engulfed by what could have been a catastrophe in which the reasonable worst-case scenario was 500,000 fatalities. And so I know, you know, that it would be madness now to throw away that achievement by allowing a second spike. We must stay alert. We must continue to control the virus and save lives. And yet we must also recognise that this campaign against the virus has come at colossal cost to our way of life. We can see it all around us in the shuttered shops and abandoned businesses and darkened pubs and restaurants. And there are millions of people who are both fearful of this terrible disease and at the same time also fearful of what this long period of enforced inactivity will do to their livelihoods and their mental and physical well-being. So I want to provide tonight for you the shape of a plan to address both fears, both to beat the virus and provide the first sketch of a roadmap for reopening society.
Mr. Johnson said people would be actively encouraged to return to their workplaces and limits on outdoor exercise would be lifted as long as social distancing was maintained. If the outbreak is contained, shops and schools may start reopening next month and some hospitality industry in July. So what did our political correspondent Rob Watson make of the Prime Minister's address to the nation?
This was, of course, a balancing act. I mean, how do you express concern for health and economics? How do you find a balance in the absence of a cure and a vaccine, which, of course, is a problem that governments face the world over? Mr. Johnson has clearly gone for a conditional approach to try and lay out a sort of, as he called it, the first sketch of a roadmap. So no detail. Much will depend, of course, from the point of view of opposition politicians and others to see, well, what is the detail that's been promised on Monday? I mean, of course, the danger with a balancing act between showing concern for health and the economy is you may end up pleasing no one.
Boris Johnson referenced a catastrophe being avoid it. But the UK has the highest death toll in Europe, the second highest in the world.
Yes, that is right. And I think this is a moment of maximum danger for the government, for Mr. Johnson and his government. Why do I say that? Because the poll ratings for the Prime Minister and the government have been very, very good. I mean, they've certainly been good. They've been dipping a little bit, but they have been good. And I think that reflects the sort of sense of a public that wants to give the government the benefit of the doubt and wants to see it do good. But a lot of the polling also suggests that people have been concerned about where Britain finds itself in terms of numbers of death. The polling suggests concerns about this issue of protective equipment and about testing, all the problems that have, of course, been well publicised here and in other countries. So the public does have concerns. And of course, this is a truism, Alex, but it's worth saying anyway. You know, the voters tend to sort of judge you on what happens next, not what came before. So of course, the real danger for the government lies ahead.
And briefly, Rob, he mentioned at the end of the address, quarantine for everyone arriving in the UK by air. That'll infuriate the airline industry. This was plugged in advance. But there are also a lot of people saying if this had only been done before, we might not be in this horrid place.
Well, as I say, this is the balancing act that the Prime Minister faces. Those who want, including many in his own Conservative Party, who would want to see the economy opened up, and those who are erring more on the side of saying, come on, why on earth didn't we do this sooner? Why would we encourage people to go back to work before we're sure that the infection rate is down?
Our political correspondent, Rob Watson. Austria began loosening its coronavirus lockdown in the middle of April, and so far it's managed to avoid a new spike in infections. However, the authorities say it's important to remain vigilant. Now, Vienna Airport has started offering COVID-19 tests for departures and on arrival for people who want to avoid 14 days in quarantine. The tests take 3 hours and cost about $200. Bethany Bell reports from Vienna.
Attention, this is a public health information for all arriving
passengers. This is the arrivals hall at Vienna Airport. And like many of the world's airports these days, it's pretty empty. A flight has just arrived from Doha, and a bit later there'll be one from Frankfurt and another from Hamburg. Now, if you are one of the small number of people arriving in Austria, you have to go into quarantine for 2 weeks unless you can show the authorities a negative COVID-19 test. When I travelled back to Vienna from Italy a few weeks ago, tests were very hard to come by and I had to go into quarantine. But now they're being offered at the airport if you're willing to pay. Günter Offner is the chief financial officer of Vienna Airport.
The demand is huge, and I think it's a real good service for those who are traveling right now and who want to be secure that they are not bearing the virus. It definitely would not work for 100,000 passengers as we have on a normal day, but it's an important first step and a service for those who are forced to travel now for a family reason or for a business reason.
Well, I've just been allowed into the room where the tests take place, and a health worker has just taken a specimen from a man's throat using a long swab. These are PCR tests. They tell you if you're currently infected with COVID-19. The specimens are analysed on the spot, and the results are usually available within 3 hours. If they're positive, the authorities are alerted. But if they're negative, people are able to move around freely. These returning travellers say that's important.
Absolutely. It's a question of safety, and because legally I would otherwise have to quarantine for 2 weeks right now, which would be much more unpleasant.
I have to work next week and my employer is paying for this, because otherwise I'm basically quarantined for 14 days. But because I can get this test, hopefully that will be cancelled, because I feel well.
Attention
please, unattended baggage will be removed by police due to security reasons.
The tests are also available for departing passengers, although people are urged to check the regulations at their destination. But now air travel remains strictly limited. I'm looking out at one of the runways at Vienna Airport and all you can see are parked planes. But there are hopes that tests could make things easier in the future, in Vienna and in other countries too.
Bethany Bell. The mistreatment of Africans in China predates the coronavirus outbreak, but there appears to be ample evidence that cases of racism are on the increase, from landlords kicking out African tenants to bus and taxi drivers refusing to accept African clients. A week ago, the authorities in the Guangdong region drew up a series of anti-discriminatory guidelines following a meeting with concerned African diplomats. So, what difference have they made? Maximus Ogbonna is president of the Association of the Nigerian Community in China. He told James Kumarasamy how the recent problems had begun.
In late March, the news was flying that the problems they have now about the virus were from foreigners, you know. So they begin to isolate or quarantine foreigners, you know, living in the city of Guangzhou.
And in particular, Africans.
Exactly, because there was a restaurant, African restaurant. It was found that there was a person there who tested positive for the COVID-19. And they think that Africans go there to eat, to relax and have their drinks. And so they suspect maybe most Africans might have, you know, got the virus.
And that led to people being kicked out of their homes, Africans not being allowed on public transport and in taxis. This was quite serious, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I need to tell you, this is not a directive from the Chinese central government, you know. They were locals. The locals were acting this on their own, you know, because they were afraid.
And this led to a meeting between African diplomats and the authorities and a new set of guidelines in place.
Now, the taxi drivers should not discriminate against black people again, have to take black people, and house owners have to, you know, rent their houses to black people. And bus drivers, you know, they need to allow, you know, black people to enter the buses in different malls and shopping centers, you know. So these are the measures they have put out to curb the problem here.
And are there punishments in place if people refuse to do that? If someone refuses to take a black person in his cab, or is it just a guideline? Is it just a recommendation?
Yes, about 2 days ago, I spoke with the high place authority here, and he told me that there's a punishment, for example, if the taxi driver doesn't allow or refuse to take a black person, he will be expelled. And if a security man refuses to allow a black person to a shopping mall or supermarket, he will be dismissed from his work.
And is it making any difference?
Yes, it's improving. Things are improving here. So, for example, the Guangzhou authorities, they brought out hotels, you know, where they put all the people who were evicted from the various houses. And people are living in those hotels free of charge. So these are one of the measures, improvements.
You've lived in China for some time. You're married to a Chinese woman, I think, and have two children. For you, what's your experience been of living in China as an African man?
I like China quite all right, but you know, China is growing from day to day, you know, they're becoming more powerful from time to time. But they need to do more and to improve the situation of things, you know, and they need to do more to make the things they do international standard. For example, they need to increase my permit. They only give me visa once in a year, you know. After 1 year, I have to drive for about 5 hours, apply for visa again, and wait to stay in a hotel. After 10 days, I will get the visa back. So that, I think that's where I'm feeling bad, my experience here as an African man living here.
Maximus Ogbonna, president of the Association of the Nigerian Community in China. During this pandemic, we've all become sadly almost used to seeing a daily tally of the number of people who've died from the disease on our TV screens and our phones as we search for the latest information globally. And as we record this podcast, that number stands at 279,311. But it grows by the hour. Each of those deaths represents a loved one, a family member, a husband, wife or child who will be grieved and terribly missed. Here in the UK and elsewhere, this has sparked a renewed interest in religion, prayer and the search for a better understanding of the meaning of life and death and hope in these dark times. As our religion editor, Martin Bashir, explains.
With so many nations severely impacted, it's hardly surprising that the language of global warfare is being used to describe responses to the coronavirus. Medical and nursing staff are said to be on the front line of the battle, and we calculate the number of casualties from London to Lesotho, Rome to Romania, Haiti to Hong Kong. It was during an actual war, the Second World War, that the BBC invited the medieval scholar C.S. Lewis to give a series of radio talks. He was invited by the then head of religious broadcasting, James Welsh, who'd read Lewis's book The Problem of Pain and was moved by one particular line. Lewis wrote, "God whispers in our pleasures, speaks to us in our conscience, and shouts to us in our pain." It certainly seems like people in Britain are listening. Before the coronavirus began to impact the nation, less than 6% of adults in the UK attended a religious service during any given week. But according to a survey of more than 2,100 people by the polling organisation ComRes, and despite churches, mosques, synagogues and other places of worship being closed, that number has now shot up to almost 25%. With people watching services online or listening to radio broadcasts. The survey also found that almost half of Britons, 44%, said they were now praying. And they're not just praying, they're talking about a subject that many of us find difficult to discuss – death. The international movement of so-called death cafes, of which there are 10,000 in 70 countries, report a record number of people wanting to discuss their fears and anxieties. Since his death in 1963, C.S. Lewis is probably best known not for his wartime talks, but for his children's stories under the overarching title The Chronicles of Narnia. What's most surprising is that although Lewis was writing for children, he chose to deal openly and frankly with death. This may have been shaped by his own experience, because his mother died after his 9th birthday. And yet, his notion of death is also shaped by hope, because Lewis, a Christian, believed in the resurrection of Christ, and therefore life after death. It's why the central character, Aslan, the great lion, rescues all of Narnia and defeats the White Witch, not in battle, but through his sacrificial death, mirroring Christ's death on the cross. One of the most moving passages about death appears in the story The Silver Chair and describes the end of the life of King Caspian. Death is dreadful, and all around are described as weeping. But suddenly, after a drop of blood from Aslan's paw falls into the stream where King Caspian lies, life begins again. Here's how Lewis describes the scene. His white beard turned to grey, and from grey to yellow, and got shorter and vanished altogether. And his sunken cheeks grew round and fresh, and the wrinkles were smoothed, and his eyes opened, and his eyes and lips both laughed, and suddenly he leapt and stood before them, a very young man. One moment, the tragedy of death, but now a resurrected life. The tragedy of the coronavirus has made us pause and look for hope, as they did during the Second World War. As C.S. Lewis wrote, "God whispers in our pleasures, speaks to us in our conscience, and shouts to us in our pain."
Martin Bashir. Still to come,
I want no other seafarer should face what we have faced. I just want each and every seafarer to know what can happen in that area, and they have to protect themselves.
A warning from an Indian sailor kidnapped off the West African coast by Nigerian pirates. The Iranian government has said it is ready for a full prisoner swap with the United States without any preconditions. Both countries have called for the release of prisoners because of the new coronavirus outbreak. An Iranian government spokesman, Ali Rabi'i, said Iran was now waiting for a US response to the offer.
We hold the American government responsible for the lives and health of all Iranian citizens who are far from their families. However, it seems that the United States is more prepared than ever to end this situation. The American government has been aware of our position for months, and we do not think there is a need for a mediator in this matter.
Talks between both sides have been going on for a while behind the scenes, and our Middle East editor, Sebastian Usher, told me who could benefit from any possible prisoner exchange.
The likeliest candidate, as far as the Iranians releasing, is a US Navy veteran called Michael White, who's been held for around 2 years. He was visiting a girlfriend in Iran. He was arrested, accused of spying, and he's been detained since then. As far as who the Iranians wish to have released from the US, that isn't so clear. I mean, there is a scientist, an Iranian in the US, has been held for some time. The charges against him have been dropped, but he's still being held awaiting deportation, so he's actually in detention, and he's had coronavirus.
So what is the US response likely to be?
Well, so far, our understanding is they don't want it to be framed as an exchange, and that they want this man, Michael White, to be freed, not as a quid pro quo. But, I mean, that doesn't mean that privately that isn't what's being discussed. And, of course, the public hostility that the Trump administration has shown towards Iran hasn't shown any sense of diminishing, and nor, it has to be said, from the Iranian side. I mean, these seem to be able to go on several levels, but the hostility, both in words and in action, can continue. But the discussion on a particular specific release can also be held. And also, for the other dual nationals, I mean, from a British perspective in particular, we have Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe. She's been sentenced to 5 years. I think she's got 1 year left, accused of spying, something obviously that she denied, the British government has denied. She is one of those who's been released on furlough at the moment, but there's concern that in the next 2 or 3 weeks she might be put back in prison, as some of those who've been released have already been sent back to prison. So her family has been speaking up for her and calling on the British government to make their position as firm and as strong as possible. And as I was saying, I think, you know, these all go on different tracks. I don't think necessarily, because the US may be coming towards a deal, that it necessarily means that this case will.
Our Middle East editor, Sebastian Usher. More than 1.5 million seafarers sail on merchant ships every year, and over 200,000 of them come from India. Pirate attacks are less of a threat than they used to be, but off the coast of West Africa, they are increasing. BBC's Kevin Ponia reports on the story of Sudeep Chowdhury, an Indian ship officer who was taken hostage in the Nigerian mangrove swamps last April.
I joined the ship in Ghana. We went to Lagos. We were in Lagos for 5 days. Then we went to Boni Island. We were told that we'll be picking up oil from the port.
Sudeep's ship was sailing near the vast wetlands of the Niger Delta, where gangs of violent criminals hide in thick mangrove forests. They have long justified their attacks on the oil industry with complaints about deep inequality and corruption.
Okay, it was like morning 4 a.m. we dropped anchor there. We finished the operation by 8 a.m. I called my parents and I called my fiancé that everything is fine. I'm absolutely fine. Everything is going okay. Then I went to sleep. At around 12:30 or 1 a.m, the EB, who was in watch in the bridge, he came down shouting that pirates are approaching.
When pirates attack these kind of ships, they always look for the foreigners first. Sudeep knew this, but his small, rusty oil tanker didn't have a safe room like many bigger ships do. So he hid the Indian crew in a storeroom. It didn't take long for the attackers to find them.
First, we were not coming out, so they started bursting in the ground. The bullet kept pierced inside my leg. Then we raised our hands. We came out. Then they told us, don't do anything. Just come with us, otherwise we'll kill you here.
The five Indians were taken to a pirate camp deep in the swampy jungle. It was clear this heavily armed group weren't new to kidnapping.
Some skeletons were hanging in the tree, they told us. It was very scary. They broke us mentally, that if you want to escape, this will happen to you.
The hostages were kept on a floating wooden platform the size of a car. They were given one bowl of noodles to share every day. Sometimes they were so thirsty they had little choice but to drink from the salty river. The pirates were often drunk. They would randomly lash out and attack the men with a piece of firewood or the back of a fish cleaver.
Hello.
Hello, you called back, I'm talking.
Okay.
It wasn't long before the pirates demanded millions of dollars from the Greek ship owner. He refused. So they turned to the families themselves to try and force his hand.
Let me tell you, they are dying. They are not in a good condition.
My friend, don't worry. Tomorrow I will pressurize this owner to call you back. Don't worry. Okay?
What you've just heard is a recording of a satellite phone call between one of the pirates and a representative of the families. But it would take many more weeks until a deal was reached. In that time, the hostages were struggling.
We used to pray silently to the God, okay, just pass this day. Because the situation was getting worse day by day. We were falling sick more frequently.
Finally, after 70 days, they were released. For Sidibe's parents, it was an emotional reunion with their only child. Such stories are sadly not uncommon. India's Director General of Shipping, Amitabh Kumar, says his agency is trying to better protect the more than 200,000 Indians who work on foreign ships every year. But he's clear about the difficulties.
There is a vessel, the owner is somewhere else, the vessel is plying somewhere else, the recruitment agent is sitting somewhere else, and everyone is trying to make money from these gullible seafarers.
Sudeep says he wants to tell his story to warn other young Indians considering a life at sea.
I want no other seafarer should face what we have faced.
Sudeep Chowdhury ending that report by Kevin Ponier. One thing we've seen across the world is governments releasing prisoners because of the threat of outbreaks of the virus in jails. But facing a public backlash, Italy's government is rolling back from a scheme that saw a number of convicted mafia figures released from jail and placed under house arrest. The scheme had been intended to help protect elderly or infirm prisoners, but it didn't differentiate between normal inmates and those convicted of serious crimes. Here's our Europe Affairs editor, Danny Eberhardt.
There was outrage when it emerged that elderly mobsters had been allowed out under house arrest. One had been involved in the murder of the teenage son of an informer whose body was dissolved in acid. Some had been held in isolation, a fact seized upon by Italy's chief anti-mafia prosecutor when questioning the likelihood of them ever catching the virus. The government was forced into damage limitation mode. First, it ordered that all new requests from mafia and terrorist convicts be reviewed by prosecutors. Now it's decreed that permissions already granted must also be reviewed. Italy's Justice Minister, Alfonso Bonafede, said such prisoners taking advantage of the coronavirus emergency to get out of jail was an insult to victims and their families.
Danny Eberhardt. Coronavirus is certainly bad news for us humans, but for many other species, it's not been such a bad thing. In India, for example, the numbers of baby olive ridley turtles has been much greater than in previous years, and it's due to coronavirus restrictions forcing people to stay at home so that the beaches, both day and night, are all theirs. Here's a Forest Department worker, Satish Kumar.
They come in hundreds of thousands to nest here. The hatchlings come out when it's warm. Every turtle lays 30 to 40 eggs or more.
And other animals are also benefiting, but our South Asia editor, Anbarasan Etarajan, started by telling me more about those turtles.
This is one of the few places in the world, in the state of Odisha, where about a 6-kilometer stretch is considered to be, you know, the largest nesting grounds for these olive ridley turtles. They come in huge numbers. It's a great spectacle to see. But what happened in the last few years or the last few decades, because of this human activity, fishing boats and also poaching by neighboring villages and the dogs coming and eating these eggs, the numbers were dwindling. In some years, they don't even come. The numbers, you know, drop significantly. But this year, that lockdown has done us some benefit for the wildlife, because at the beginning of this period of lockdown in late March, that was one of the seasons when this when the mother turtles coming and lay the eggs. Most of the villages were under lockdown, which means people cannot come and take the eggs. And also the fishing activity was less along the coast, which means the turtles can come to the beaches without any interference. And that's why, according to some estimates by these wildlife officials, more than 2 million baby turtles have gone back to the sea in the last few weeks.
And it's not just turtles that are benefiting, is it?
It's not so simply turtles. Like in India, it's like, you find wildlife everywhere. And as many people would tell you that elephants, which normally come to some of the, agricultural lands in southern India and the eastern part, now they come, very regularly because the fences have been destroyed. Nobody is going to replace, so they are coming in. And in the Ganges River, people are spotting dolphins because the river is clean. There are no boats going around this Ganges area, so you see the dolphins more. And in the Sundarbans mangrove forest in northeast of India, in the West Bengal state, where the forest department officials say they are sighting tigers more often. Instead of twice a week, they are now sighting tigers at least 6 times a week. That's a big achievement.
And Barasan Etarajan. So now, many weeks into social distancing measures, how are countries faring where people usually embrace or kiss each other as a greeting? Before the pandemic, in France and Switzerland, up to 4 kisses or bis were normal, even welcomed. But are we about to kiss goodbye to these familiar cultural habits? Matteo Avanzi is Professor of Linguistics at Sorbonne University in Paris and told us about how the pause on French kissing is affecting his country.
Now, if you go on social media, people get crazy with this. And every time somebody is talking about the future of the bees, everybody is talking, oh, we should abandon this behavior. It's so stupid. And I'm so happy because this is one of the good sides of COVID-19. I will not have to make la bise when I go to my office and to kiss people that I don't like because they have bad breath or because they have crusty hair or whatever. I'm very surprised because many people didn't dare to say, I'm bored to do the bees and I'm uncomfortable doing the bees. But this COVID virus came and people now start to be happy to say, yeah, I want to get rid of this behavior. This is very a pity because bees is something which is very French. It's like the bread and the hat, so it's something that is a part of our culture. But I think it's not a bad thing if it go back to what it was a few dozens of years before. But I really hope it's not going to disappear because, yes, it's something that is really associated to the French culture.
A kiss of thanks to Matteo Avanzi, Professor of Linguistics at Sorbonne University in Paris. And he definitely doesn't have crusty hair. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.